really value good relationships, good deep relationships. You know that lovely proverb? Better a meal of vegetables where there is love than the fattened calf with hatred. You know that one? It's lovely, isn't it? And it really resonates, doesn't it, that is surely true, but to have good relationships, even if we don't have very much else, is very, very valuable. And you obviously do value that as a church, because the third of your vision aims is that you should be a reminder in which each one matters and people's needs are cared for. In which each one matters and people's needs are cared for. A reminder in which love has its part. And that's what we're really going to talk about this afternoon, finally. And we're going to think about what two qualities are needed for good relationships. I suppose if we ask people outside the church, they would say all sorts of things. They might say, well, you have to be compatible. Two people have to be rather like each other and fit. They might say, you need time to build good relationships. Patience, understanding, all of these things. And that's fair enough. So far as it goes. They might say love. But then what is love? I think most people today mean being in love. They mean something like Art Garfunkel sung about, are the stars out tonight? I don't know if it's cloudy or bright. I only have eyes for you. So I love it, but I think love is a little bit more than that. And as I say, you have said that you want love for one another to be at the heart of our life together. What is love, though? Let's define it. And I think that we're going to look this afternoon at two qualities which the Bible says are at the heart of love and at the heart of building good relationships. Now, the relationship we're specifically thinking about is within the church family, within the Gemeinde. But I think what we're going to see today actually applies in all relationships which we have. Some of us are students, we have a certain, a group we go to lectures with or study with, and it will apply to those relationships. Some of us perhaps share a house with others or a flat. And if we want to build good relationships with those others, these things will help us. Some of us are married. This is how to have a strong marriage. Some of us are preparing for marriage. Many of us will be married one day. These are qualities which we can begin to practice now, which will help us to build a strong marriage and family. Now, the letter to the Ephesians is really, it's got two halves, as so many of Paul's letters have. The first half is all about unity between God and man, God reconciling humanity to himself. The second half is about unity between man and man, person and person. God reconciling people to himself, and then in the second half, reconciling them to one another, or them getting on with one another. And that starts with 4:1, that second half. Now, the passage we're studying today, 4:25, is the beginning of the real nitty-gritty. This is where he really gets down to basics. Actually gets down to the practice. And so what we're going to look at today is the nitty-gritty of relationship building. You can see from this passage, if you look at 5:2, that what he's talking about is a life of love, because he says, live a life of love. And there are a number of different things he says in the passage we're looking at, but I think that we can gather them together into two headings. And the first heading is this, be honest. Be honest. And I particularly want to focus on verse 25. Put off falsehood and speak truthfully. Put off falsehood and speak truthfully. Now, obviously, that's got a literal sense, isn't it? He's saying don't tell lies. When I was preparing this, just recently, I happened to speak to somebody on the phone. Her name was Barbara, and she worked for a bank. And she just happened to say that she's now stopped, she's a Christian, and she worked for this bank, and they, I didn't know the exact details, but they asked her to lie. They asked her to speak to a client and once a year, and they said something to the client, I don't know what it was, and basically she was lying. And they said, well, that's what everybody does. You know, that is just what happens in the industry. And she said, no, I did. And that's part of the reason she left the bank. But what I want to argue this afternoon is that when Paul says this, speak truthfully, and put up falsehood, he's going much further than that. He's saying something more. I think he's saying, be open with each other. Be frank, be real. Take off the mask. Be honest. Actually tell people what you're thinking, what you're really feeling. And I want to explain why I think that, because it's perhaps not immediately obvious when you look at the passage. So I'm just going to try and persuade you from that. So it's not just me saying that, so that we are convinced together that this is what the Word of God is saying. First of all, really, because when we come to commandments in the Bible like this, I think that the example of the Lord Jesus would encourage us not just to see them at a literal level. So do you remember how Jesus treated the commandments? He said, take the commandment, do not murder. What's that actually mean? He said, you know, it doesn't just mean not killing. He said, when you hate somebody, that actually is murder in your heart. He said, what is the command, do not commit adultery? It's not just literally. He said, if you look at somebody lustfully, wanting to go to bed with them, that is adultery. The command covers that as well. So I think we're encouraged to take these commands further than just the literal level. Secondly, the whole flow of this letter, but in verse 25, it gives a reason why we should speak truthfully. He says, for we are all members of one body. Now, that is a... If we just read that on its own, not the flow of the letter, we might just skip over that. But for we are all members of one body should ring lots of bells if you know this letter to the Ephesians. Because it's one of the things that Paul has been... one of the pictures Paul has been using to describe the church. And we just have a look back to chapter 4, verse 4. There is one body. And 4:16, the whole body. And what he's saying, you see, is that the church, the Gemeinde, is like a body. And we're all part of the body. Like a body has hands, eyes, ears, feet, and so on. And each of those parts of, you know, well, they don't sort of have to. I mean, they work together. They are a unity, and he said, that's what the congregation, the Gemeinde, is actually like. And he said, therefore, and this is his big thrust, this is really, I think, the big thrust of the letter to the Ephesians, 4 verse 3, make every effort to keep the unity. That is what you are, so make every effort to be united. Now, I think that he says, well, I'm sure that in all these commands that follow, we must be careful to connect them back to what he said about being united and being one body. So when we come to this command, speak the truth, it's not just that kind of, he's just thought, woken up Monday morning and thought, oh, well, what shall I tell him to do today? Not lie. That's a good thing to tell him. He's actually choosing things to tell them that will help them to maintain unity as a congregation. Help them to be one, to think, you know, not all think exactly the same way like robots, but to be like a team working together. Now, it just seems to me that, and incidentally, one of the things I've learned from studying Ephesians is how very important unity is. And we were discussing this in one of the small groups yesterday. It is tremendously important that we do try and come to a agree on things and to work together. And it's very, very difficult. As a pastor of the church, it's one of the things I've realized, that it's actually very difficult to create and maintain that. Of course, you can't do it, it's got to be God's work, but it needs constant attention. Now, I think that bearing that in mind, that Paul must have more in mind here than just lying, literal lying, because lying amongst Christians, I mean, it does happen, but it's not terribly common. And I don't think it's a major issue or sort of divisions. I mean, I haven't often come across churches where they've had splits and suppose people lie to each other. But I do think that there is a deeper form of untruthfulness, of falsehood, which really does cause divisions. And that is this business of reserve, of false, having a false front, of hiding our feelings, of being, as we say in England, I don't know if you say this in Germany, a closed book. You have that expression in a closed book. And that's what a lot of people like, isn't it? Or some people particularly like. It's like a closed book. And you just don't know what's in between the cupboards. And what you long to be able to do is open the book and look inside and see what's in there. And that's what you long to do with these people, to open the cupboards and say, what's, you know, what is actually in the heart? What's actually in the mind? And I think that kind of openness, I'm not saying that we should, let me say this right now, I'm not saying we should go around bearing our heart to everybody. There is a time and a place. But surely it is that kind of openness which is so relationship building, isn't it? And it's excessive reserve that is so destroying a relationship. I mean, think of the people that you have the deepest relationships with. It is the people who are open with you, isn't it? And with whom you can be open. And you sometimes maybe you go out or you meet somebody or there are even people in the church and you just feel, I just don't know this person. And it's rather frustrating. And the relationship just isn't there. And I think that Paul puts this first in the list. In truthful, because that's what he's talking about, and because it is so important for relationship building, for unity. I didn't think he would put it first in the list if he was just literally talking about lying. And then I think also that this connection with, he goes on to speak in verse 26, in your anger, do not sin, and do not let the sun go down while you're still angry. I think what he's talking about there is, deal with your anger. I think he's saying literally you have to deal with it on the same day, but I think he's saying don't let it fester, then let it go on, and one of the ways in which you often have to deal with it is by speaking to somebody truthfully. See, I think that's the connection of thought. He's thought, speak truthfully, be honest, be open. Now, what's one of the times when we have to do that specifically? These are when there's agreements. Actually, one of the times when there's most danger of falsehoods, when there's agreements, when something's gone wrong between us. And we hide that and don't deal with it, talk it through. And I think that's the connection of thought there, and that leads me to conclude that when he talks about truthfulness, he is talking about something deeper. I'm not incidentally saying either that if we are angry, it's always right to speak to somebody. Somebody came up to him. You heard John Wesley, an England great preacher in England. A man came up to him once and he said, my talent is to speak my mind. And Wesley said to him, well, sir, that is one talent that God wouldn't mind visiting buried. Say, not always, but having said that, I think there should be people with whom we take off the mask, so to speak. And it may only be 2, 3, 4 people. I'm not saying everybody. But I think there should be people with whom we're doing that in the Gemeinde. And that, of course, is very appealing. It's very appealing to the outside world, I think. friends called Peter Adam went to be the vicar of St. Jude's in Melbourne in Australia. His church is in a student area. And he asked a friend, because he's never ministered among students before, he said, what can I do in this church? What can I offer that will be attractive to students? And this man said that students are looking for authenticity. Authenticity. And they find that very attractive. And I think actually that does, don't they? People being real with one another. So rare. So let's ask ourselves, am I an honest person? Have I taken off the mask? Have I put on truth? And we must do that if we are to have good relationships and deep the unity of the Spirit. So the first thing that Paul says here is be honest. The second thing I would suggest he says is be generous. Be honest, be generous. And I've got three sort of subheadings under this. Material generosity, verbal generosity, and attitudinal generosity. I'll explain these as we get through. First of all, material generosity. Verse 28, talking about the thief, must steal no longer, but must work, doing something useful with his own hands. And then here I think is the revolutionary bit. Why must he work? That he may have something to share with those in need. Isn't that a revolutionary incentive for work and for earning? So that you might have something to share. Now, I received through the post the other day this brochure for a savings plan. And it's giving me various incentives to save and to gather money. Because I don't want to work all my life. I'm working here, is it? It's not getting involved in my office, but anyway. Because I don't want to work all my life. I'm building a secure base for my family. Because I love this one, because I'm really going places. So I want to earn money so I can really go places, rowing up and down the river. Peace of mind is important to me. The future's looking bright. To live life as I want to. And I'm just looking to see where it says, so that I'll be able to share with others. No, I haven't found it. It's not what we'll ever be told, is it, by the world. Now, of course, it's not wrong to save for ourselves, to provide for our family, and so on. But the Bible is saying the great motivation for working, for earning, for money, is to share with others in need. And again, you see, we can just say that, and we all agree with that, but let's link it back with being one body and having a unity, because that's why he says it, I think, because it's so relationship building. It's so good for unity, because what differences of wealth divide, don't they? Very literally, where you live. The rich people live in one part of town, the poor people live in another part of town. And we've got this great opportunity within the Christian fellowship to begin to break down some of those barriers. It's not easy at all, but I think it does happen. And we can see that. Certainly in our congregation at home, we've got very rich people, and we've also got very poor people. It does cause us tensions. I mean, when we have church things, sometimes we go to the big houses of the people, and somebody said to me the other day, I mean, do you realise that for some of the congregation, going to that house is like going to what we call a national trust property, like a sort of stately home, you know? And they're not quite that big, but that's what it feels like. And it can be difficult, but on the other hand, you can't break down the barriers, because in England, that would never normally happen. The upper middle classes, the wealthy, they never have these people in their homes. It's lovely that we begin to break that down and share and create a unity like that. But our generosity must extend further than that. It must be verbal. It must be in what we speak. Verse 28. Where am I? Sorry, verse 29. Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up. I used to think the word unwholesome there meant sort of dirty jokes and crude talk, but actually it doesn't. Literally it means, it was a word used of rotten fruit and fish. And I think we can see what it means by looking at the opposite. We should have speech which is helpful, verse 29, building up, and benefits. And the last word there, benefit, is literally give grace. And that reminds us and takes us back to 4 verse 7, which says that grace has been given as Christ apportioned it. And in that context, grace means a gift, a certain ability, a certain talent, a certain gift to do something. And I think he uses the same word in verse 29 to say that we should be commenting on people's gifts. We should have speech that, in English, that the jargon word is affirms people, that affirms them, that builds them up. Now it's curious, isn't it, that we love to dwell on people's weaknesses. We love to criticize more than we love to praise. And we love putting others right rather than celebrating what they've got right. Now, of course, weaknesses and failures do need talking about. And we need to balance this point with the first one about being honest. But on the other hand, most of us actually, I think there are some exceptions to this, but most people are only too aware of their weaknesses and their failures. And they don't actually need their noses rubbing on them. What they need is praise and affirmation, and being told what they're good at, and being told what their gifts are, and their skills, and how they contribute. And again, you see, we can link this back to this unity theme, getting on with one another. Because criticism is so divisive. In research that's been carried out about marriage breakdown, they've discovered that there are four factors that are present in all marriages which break down. First, criticism. And I think all the others spring out of that. Criticism is so divisive. Whereas affirmation is so relationship building. There's an old saying, that we should ask ourselves before we speak, is it kind? Is it necessary? Is it true? Is it kind? Is it necessary? Is it true? I've got a friend at home who sticks absolutely rigidly to that rule, and I have to say sometimes I've been slightly irritated by it, because I've been rather cross with somebody, and I've been talking to her, and I wanted, you know, in a Christian way, of course, talking about perhaps what we'll pray about this person. But really what I've been wanting to do is get the knife out and stick it in and give it a good twist. And she won't do it. And sometimes it's been rather irritating. But it's irritating to me because I'm sinful. And actually she's right. So verbal generosity. And the third kind is what I've called, and I can't think of a better word, it's not a good word, attitudinal generosity, being generous in our attitudes. And I think this comes out of verse 31 and 32 and sums those up. 31 seems to be progressive, each term or pair of terms taking the others further, starting with bitterness, which is a kind of inner resentment, rage and anger, which is sort of outbursts of bad temper. Brawling and slander seems to be running others down behind their back, and then malice seems to be summing it all up. What's the opposite of those things? Verse 32, kind, compassionate, and forgiving. And all of those are generous attitudes, aren't they? Forgiveness is compared in the Gospels with letting somebody off a debt. They owe you something. Like they owe you 100 marks. You say no, forget it. That compassion, feeling with others, that means moving out of our cozy, comfortable, secure, peaceful little existence. And it means entering somebody else's pain and hurt. It's costly to do that. Kindness is giving to others what they don't deserve. That is a generous thing to do. When I think of kindness, my mind often turns to C.S. Lewis. I don't think you appreciate his books and know them. They're amongst my favourites. He's a brilliant English scholar. Taught at Penn, first at Oxford University, and then was a professor at Cambridge. And he's written books which have been helpful to millions and millions of Christians. A brilliant man. And a woman called June was once staying in his house in Kidlington, just outside Oxford. Big rambling house, he lived there with his brother. And there was a boy who worked for him in the garden. And this boy had a little, he was adult, actually, a young man that had a mental age of 8. He's retired. And he longed to learn to read. And June said she was so struck by seeing this brilliant man, evening by evening, for a month, trying to teach this man to read, making up little letters with pictures on them, putting them down, and night after night, he was without much success at all, but carrying on. Isn't that a lovely picture, this brilliant man doing that? That's kindness. Stooping, as it were, to somebody so much below his ability. Now, we do have to keep emphasising this because Christians, sadly, very often have not lived up to it. John Owen was a great leader in the Church of England, a great Puritan. In the 17th century, he was actually the minister of the church where I am for about 2.5 years. And he said this, talking about certain Christians. They have a zeal for religion, but it is accompanied with want of forbearance. They separate from the world, but live wholly to themselves, taking no care to exercise loving kindness on the earth. They talk spiritually and live vainly. Mention communion with God and are in every way conformed to the world. Boasting of forgiveness of sin and never forgiving others. It's curious, isn't it? The Christians who know themselves to be failures can't forgive failure in others. The Christians who have experienced such immense generosity to themselves cannot be generous towards others. And I think we have to say, you know, that it's Christians perhaps with the highest moral and doctrinal standards, and I include you in that, you are in most danger of getting wrong on this one. Because we are trying to live and be the best for God. And it becomes, I think, very easy to become hard on each other and on others who don't live up to those standards. Now again, link this back to his call to be united. He's criticising this attitude of putting others right and not forgiving is so divisive, isn't it? Who are the people you don't want to be with? I can think of fellow Christians I just don't want to be with. Not because of what they say, but because I just know what their attitude is. I just know they're waiting to put me right. I just know they see all too well my failures. It's just obvious in their face. It's obvious in their body language. It's obvious in their reserve. But they think I'm doing wrong. I'm not bringing my children up very well, for example. Which I often think is terribly difficult. But I didn't expect all that. And I just take my feet with them. Not because I want to evade criticism. I mean, I just know it, that actually with friends and the people I'm going to be close with, I just want to be with people who will encourage me. And we'll have that attitude, not waiting to judge and to put right. So I think we need to ask ourselves as well, am I honest? Am I generous? Am I a generous person? Have I taken off that mean heart and put on a big heart? Am I generous with my things, my words, and my attitudes? Now, you know, as I thought about these two qualities, the more I thought about them, the more I think that they are very revolutionary, very important. Be honest, be generous. Because it seems to me that it is lack of these two things which is so often put non-church people off the Christian faith. Paul goes on after this passage to talk about sexual morality, and that is of course important, vital. But actually before that, he says, be honest, be generous. And I guess it is true in the past that the church has talked a lot about sex, a lot about sexual morality, but has not actually shown much honesty or much generosity. And that has done great damage. Is it possibly what John Lennon meant when he said, I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Now, as we said, he wasn't actually much better himself. His son, Julian, said of his dad, he was a hypocrite. Dad could talk about peace and love out loud to the world, but he could never show it to the people who supposedly meant most to him, his wife and his son. And he's talking about the fact that when he was 85, John Lennon walked out on his wife and set up with the OK. But nevertheless, even though the world can point at us and say we're hypocrites, they're probably hypocrites themselves, but nevertheless, there is a point there, isn't there? All I want is the truth. And we must be zealous to show the world that. Now, if you know anything about the New Testament, if you know anything about Christianity, really, you will not be surprised that Paul doesn't stop there. He doesn't just say, be honest, be generous, and we talked a little bit about this morning. He says why we should do this. He motivates us to do it. He says, this is how we should be, because God has loved us. God has been generous towards us. Look at all these motivational reminders. Verse 32. Forgiving just as in Christ God forgave you. 5 verse 1. As dearly loved children. Verse 2. As Christ loved us. Now we understand why in the first half of the letter Paul has been going on about what God has done for us. Now we understand chapter 2 verse 1 to 10 and why Paul wrote it. It wasn't a great doctrinal treatise. He didn't just get carried away. He didn't just say, I'll write a nice passage about the grace of God and get all excited about it and perhaps turn it into a hymn. He was writing because he wanted to motivate Christians to live the loving life. And he wanted to remind them that we were disobedient, we were following the ways of the world, we were following the ways of the devil, we were dead, we were under his wrath, and he didn't say, you filthy lot, I'm not going to have anything to do. You know, just get lost. Is that the way I'm going to behave? I'm washing my hands of you. No, he didn't. He looked at us, he saw us like that, and what did he do? He sent his son into the world to die. To rescue. To say, I'll put all that behind us. I will disregard that. No, you're not looking for me. No, you're not religious. No, you're not kind. No, you're not good. You're as rotten could be. You're ugly. You're horrid. But I love you. And I'll rescue you. Now, my friends, if we can't be generous and loving to others when God has been like that to us, we've either never understood what he's done or we've forgotten it. And that is why if we're not like that, the chances are we're not actually Christians. Somebody said, they who talk of the grace of God to themselves and will not manifest it to others are deceiving themselves if they think they dwell in safety. Their faith is in vain. No one can truly receive grace from God and not show grace to fellow human beings. So let me finish on that. I always pray with talks and sermons at home on a weekend like this that they would lead not just to head knowledge. It's always a fear, I think, for a preacher that they will teach, and both for themselves and for others, all it will lead to is just knowing more, and that's really not much use at all. So we do pray that what we say will affect our own lives and the lives of those who listen, and that's what I pray for us as we go from here. And just can I leave you with these two questions as we go? Am I being honest? Am I being generous? Am I being honest? Am I being generous? Is there some bitterness perhaps I'm harboring, some secret resentment against somebody else? Well, that needs to be dealt with. Is there somebody I need to be honest with, that I ought to be honest, that I ought to be less reserved with? Have I lost sight, perhaps, of sharing with others as a major point of earning a living and of saving? Have I perhaps got into a habit of judging and criticizing others? Have I actually never really opened up to anybody, maybe outside my own family, maybe not even them? And I think I need to look for somebody with whom I can do that. So let's deal with these things, for if we are believers, we are members of one body, and because I think this is something of what it means to be a reminder in which love for one another is at the heart of our life together. Be honest, be generous.